Good day and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kate Harner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome and thank you for calling into Cigna's Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Harner and I am a care manager on the Eating Disorder team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of this conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions on today's seminar. A handout for today's presentation is available online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side of the screen, you'll want to click on the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on the link that says Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, click on the link that says Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. At the top of the screen by today's date, you'll find today's handout. Again, visit us online at www.cignabehavioral.com. On the left-hand side, click on the link that says Visit Our Education and Resource Center. Then click on Eating Disorder Education and Resources. And finally, click on Eating Disorder Awareness, a Cigna Education Series. And at the top of the screen by today's date, you'll find today's handout. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Oviedo Bermudez. Dr. Bermudez is the Medical Director of Child and Adolescent Services and Chief Medical Officer at Eating Recovery Center. Today he'll be sharing information with us on some causes of eating disorders. Welcome, Dr. Bermudez.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning, everybody, or I guess it's good afternoon for some of you. We have 31 slides to go through, unfortunately, this is not going to be interactive at this point, so I imagine that the best approach is just really to go through the slide materials and be able to make my comments to you and hope that that's helpful, and then we can get to the question and answer period have a little bit of more discussion there. So to begin with, let's go to slide two. I have no conflict of interest or pertinent financial disclosures to report related to this presentation at this point. All right, so going on to slide three, I think that most of us would agree that, we've been talking about eating disorders as biopsychosocial illnesses for some time. As a matter of fact, this is quite an old slide. I think I probably made up this slide a good 20 years ago, and that concept hasn't changed. I think what has changed is our understanding of each of those components, the psychological component of eating disorders, the social context in which eating disorders are more likely to occur, and of course there is greater understanding of the input of biology, specifically the input of familiarity and heritability, which are really some of the things that we hope to discuss with you this morning, because that's where I think we can best understand what may predispose someone to this illness and understand what may precipitate the onset or clinical presentation of these illnesses, and hence I think open a window for families to be aware as to how to recognize these illnesses early. We do, I think, know that early recognition and early intervention are still quite important as we better address the needs of this patient population. The other side of, I think, a good reason to have this conversation is that if we understand what predisposes to the illness and what may precipitate the illness, this also lends itself to a bit of a conversation around an aspect of understanding relapse prevention once successful treatment has occurred. In other words, the predisposing factors especially the ones that have to do with constitutionality, with familiarity, with temperament, are likely to remain with the individual. And, of course, some of the precipitating factors in many ways may be the same that would, in some cases, precipitate a relapse, or if not the same, at least similar or related. So going on to the fourth slide, I think that again, want to make a little bit of comment as to some fundamental premises around how we think about eating disorders. They are psychiatric illnesses, with the caveat that there is both a very significant medical morbidity, meaning medical complications and mortality, but also significant psychiatric morbidity and psychiatric mortality. So important to think about these illnesses as complex from both the medical perspective and the psychiatric perspective. There is very limited evidence to support our interventions. However, this evidence is growing. So we're looking, for example, we don't have strong evidence for the use of medications in anorexia nervosa, for example. But we are building evidence for the use of some biologicals, like the use of fluoxetine and perhaps other SSRIs in bulimia nervosa and maybe even in binge eating disorder. FBT or family behavioral therapy certainly has growing evidence to support its use in especially the younger presentations of an eating disorder. Where I think we lack is in other areas, but one of the areas where I think is very important to be extremely aware about is the fact that nutritional rehabilitation in the context of any eating disorder syndrome, but certainly in an underweight syndrome, is I think of great importance and something that should be a part of any treatment effort, regardless of the other components of that treatment effort. And of course, we also know today that these are illnesses that affect people from all walks of life, from both genders, all races and ethnicities, in nearly all ages. I think that the youngest person I've encountered diagnosable formally with an eating disorder has been 8 years of age, and the oldest person 67 years of age. So at least that has been my clinical experience in the last couple of decades. So moving on to slide 5, topics for discussion. Really want to sort of talk about this idea of what causes an eating disorder. Not that I know the answer. I just think that there are some concepts. First, I don't know that there is one answer. Second, I think there are some concepts that not only is it important to be aware of, but also to be important to dialogue about. I think that part of our advocacy opportunity is being able to have, informed conversations around this, even when we encounter people who become inquisitive. And, of course, then we will go on to talk a little bit about understanding predisposing factors and understanding precipitating factors. Again, looking at it from the early recognition, timely intervention perspective, and also from perhaps how this may inform how we think about relapse prevention, at least in some ways. Okay, so what causes an eating disorder? What can we say about that? Well, part of the point of this conversation today is that eating disorders are familial. So there is a familial genetic component that the literature clearly supports. And that's not to say that it's because families cause eating disorders. I don't know that we pass on an eating disorder. It's just that I think it's important to understand then how does this concept of familiarity and heritability really work. So I want to walk with you a little bit through the three layers of information that we have around this, the first of which is refers to familial genetics. And familial genetics, in a way, is about kind of observing what is the increased likelihood of a phenotype, right? Meaning an expression. In this case, you know, anorexia would be a phenotype, bulimia would be a phenotype, binge eating disorder would be a phenotype. The expression of a phenotype as it runs in a family line. In other words, if a relative is affected, what is the greater or lesser risk that an individual in that family will be affected by these illnesses? And so this was sort of the first wave of data that pointed to the fact that, yes, eating disorders are familial illnesses. And if you sort of compile that work, I think that the conclusion can be that, you know, if an individual has a first-degree relative or a second-degree relative with an eating disorder, then the relative risk, you know, as compared to the general population of that individual going on to be affected by an eating disorder, in other words, to express that phenotype, is, 12-fold for anorexia nervosa as compared to the general population, and 4-fold for bulimia nervosa as compared to the general population. Now, I guess one question that comes to this is, why the difference? Why, you know, is then anorexia more heritable than bulimia? And I think that would be a complicated issue to sort of tease out. But one way of sort of thinking about that would be that because bulimia in a sense is more heterogeneous than anorexia, it may be the way that this plays out. Rather than just the fact that one is more heritable than the other, or how to establish a hierarchy from this piece of information. Suffice it to say that the implication of this is that absolutely these are illnesses that run in families. So next came the question of, then how do we think about where this inheritance comes from, right? So if things run in families, we should have some genetic explanation at the molecular level, right? So we should have some explanation that is quote unquote identifiable in the genes, in order to kind of make sense of that familiarity, because we could also say, well, that this may have to do with environmental factors, for example. Now, some illnesses, as we think about molecular genetics, some illnesses have what is called genetic determinism. A good example is Down syndrome or trisomy 21. If any individual, any human being ended up, at the time of conception, ended up with three chromosomes in the position 21, hence the term quote unquote trisomy 21, they would develop Down syndrome. And they would develop Down syndrome quite similar clinical presentation. And that's more of a genetic determinism. When it comes to eating disorders, we're not even close to, identifying a genetic defect or a genetic, change like this. So the idea was to do linkage studies to sort of narrow down the areas that may be worth studying further. And so both the Price Foundation initially and then the National Institute of Mental Health funded linkage studies where, in other words, taking mothers and daughters that had both been affected and sort of looking at their whole genome and saying, in what areas of the genome and what chromosomes do these individuals that share this illness, this phenotypical expression, share more genetic material. And that was found to be in chromosome 1 for anorexia nervosa and in chromosome 10 for bulimia nervosa. Of interest in those studies, in chromosome 14, there was some linkage peaks both for anorexia and for bulimia. So I think the intent of linkage studies would be to say, well, gee, perhaps we can sort of narrow down the search and focus on some areas. Now, as technology advanced, the reality is that there is newer technology that can look in faster and less costly ways sort of at the genome-wide. And even with those advances, I don't think that we are, you know, anywhere on the threshold of having a specific molecular defect identified for anorexia and for bulimia. Whether we look at, you know, what is called candidate genes and sort of searching for, well, gee, maybe this is where the defect could lie based on some theoretical explanation, or looking genome-wide. Much work to be done in that area. So the third sort of component of this data has been through what is called heritability estimates. And as you see on slide 9, we can define heritability estimates by being a statistical analysis of the probability or impact of genetics accounting for environmental factors. So it's a way of sort of teasing out, you know, what is genetics versus what is environmental. And, of course, in this, they analyze the interaction of the genetic influence, but then separating the environmental influence into shared environmental factors and unique environmental experiences. So a good example of how to think about heritability estimates is to compare, the expression of a phenotype, in identical twins that, of course, share 100% of the genetic material versus in comparing that in non-identical twins, and then statistically teasing out what has influenced, you know, the expression of a particular phenotype, in this case an eating disorder, because of the unique experiences twins reared together. Their shared experiences, twins reared together tend to have pretty similar shared experiences, right? Similar parents, similar parenting, they the same stage of or timing when it concerns, you know, to family logistics and the like, versus unique experiences, the things that that are experienced by one twin and not necessarily the other, or experienced differently. An example that I like to use with this is, two identical twins walking down a path, and one of them is attacked. So she becomes the victim of an attack, and her identical twin sister becomes the witness of an attack. And, of course, those are unique experiences because even though they were both there at the same time, the personal experience becomes different in a sense. And if we sum up, if you looking at slide 10, if we sum up, the heritability estimates for eating disorders, you can see that, you know, they're ranked side by side with other psychiatric and other illnesses that, you know, we think have, pretty strong heritability. So autism, for example, it is felt that between 80 and 100%, hence the 0.8 to 1.0, component of its heritability is genetic. Same for schizophrenia, from 0.5 to 0.9. And it turns out that anorexia and bulimia have a pretty strong genetic component, between 50 and 80% of the effect. So very similar to schizophrenia in that sense, is accounted for by the genetic component. Now, of interest, this is another set of data, sort of compiling data, is that non-shared or unique environmental effects really take sort of a second place compared to genetic effects in the effect of heritability overall. And as you can see, a shared environment has relatively, little influence. So in this particular set of data, we could see that the genetic effect for bulimia is between 59 and 83%, in some ways quite similar to the genetic effect of anorexia, between 58 and 76%. In both cases, the shared environmental effects don't play much of a role, 0%, and of course the unique or non-shared environmental effects, between 17 to 41% for bulimia and between 24 and 42% of the effect for anorexia nervosa. Clearly, I think what this sort of alludes to is the implication that, yes, there is a strong genetic influence in the heritability of eating disorders, followed by unique experiences or non-shared environmental effects, and less important influence from the shared environmental effects. Another way of sort of looking at this, going on to slide 12, this was the work of Cindy Bulick, published in 2006, is, you know, looking at the heritability of anorexia specifically, in which in non-identical twins, the likelihood was 5% that they would share the illness, but in identical twins, the likelihood was 56% of the time, both twins would express the illness. And of course, that is a, you know, quite a significant difference. And very much alluding to the fact that the genetic component is you know, quite influential, given that identical twins have identical genetics, and non-identical twins are more like you know, brothers or sisters, in which there is some sharing of the genetics, but clearly not identical, so quite different from that perspective. And so this brings us to the idea of gene-environment interaction, you know, how to think about the fact that if there is not a determinant, you know, genetic defect for eating disorders, then, you know, how do we think about this heritability, this important genetic component, and how does that interact with the environment? Because, you know, it's become pretty clear that eating disorders don't happen equally in all environments. So there are, you know, natural experiments like the Fiji studies, the work of Ann Becker, that clearly saw that under certain you know, social cultural contexts, like before you know, the television becoming more widely available, especially westernized television becoming more widely available in the Fiji Islands, you know, body image and eating disorder related issues were you know, very, very low in their expression there. So so how do we think about the fact that even though the genetic impact is significant, there is an interplay with environment. And so this concept of gene environment interaction you know, came about through the work of Caspi, so I'm having a little trouble advancing my slides. I hope everybody else is not in the same situation. Try something else here. Okay, so let's see, I've gone on to slide 14, and what you can see is this graph that really talks a bit about this gene-environment interaction, work of Caspi, published in 2003. And, you know, just to walk you through this a little bit, as you can see on the top of the slide, there are the symbols for the short allele and the long allele of a serotonin receptor, and of course these are different expressions, I guess, in a way, of how likely an individual is to be genetically influenced to have certain mood responses, and this is a genetic marker for that. So what the study did essentially was to look at the probability of a person, a young woman in this case, developing a major depressive episode at age 26, sort of looking at the stressful life events that happened between the ages of 22 and 26 for that woman, and separating them depending on, you know, into three groups, depending on sort of their genetic predisposition to mood, you know, to depression, if you will, by looking at, again, whether they were, you know, what's called homozygous, the circles with a line through, were, you know, both had short arms of that particular gene. Then the squares had you know, one short arm, one long arm, and then the red triangles had two long arms. And what you can see is that if you start, you know, at 0.0, you know, their probability of having had a major depressive episode, you know, was very similar. And then they had one significant dramatic event. But then the probability of major depression was, again, very similar. But if we go to the second significant traumatic event, we can see that there begins to be slightly more separation, meaning that the more environmental push, the more negative, unique experiences in this case, I guess, that were present, then the people who were more genetically vulnerable began to express this possibility to a greater extent. And by the third traumatic life event, or stressful life event, I should say, you could see that the separation was greater, and those with the open circles were more likely to develop major depressive episodes. And by the fourth stressful life event, you can see that the separation is even greater. You know, the implication there is clearly there is an interaction, not just with our, you know, between our genetic potential, but what happens through life that you know, that really matters. And so, you know, this brought us to, you know, the question, if we go on to the next slide, or slide 15, as to you know, is there an anorexia or bulimia nervosa gene that we're going to identify, you know, and that's unlikely. That's really unlikely. A couple of, I guess, ways of thinking about that would be that, you know, there has been a historical evolution of eating disorder symptoms that seems to be culturally influenced. So there is, it's more complex than just a genetic defect, because environment counts, you know, personal experiences count, and the cultural context, really counts. So as opposed to Down syndrome, which has been, you know, very much the same, you know, as long as we've had a historical, record of it, when it comes to eating disorders, there's been a shift. So there was a couple of hundred years of anorexia nervosa history, for example, without drive for fitness, and then sometime around the time of the Industrial Revolution, in cities and magazines, and, you know, sort of a norm of beauty, the evolution of all of this sort of brought drive for thinness into the picture. So that's an important shift, if you will, if we think about, you know, purging syndromes, and you know, now the association with self-harm syndromes and multi-impulsive syndromes. These were not things that we were observing before, but we're clearly observing now. So there is an evolution. And, of course, we can think about this whole idea of the spectrum of eating disorder-related pathology growing, in the sense that, you know, if we listen to the lay press, we now talk about people with, you know, diabulimia and, you know, drunkorexia and orthorexia and, you know, so on and so forth, really implying different manifestations of these illnesses. And because it's unlikely that the genetic component, right, that our genetics have changed in the span of time that we're talking about, even if we were talking about, you know, a couple of hundred years, chances are that there is significant influence from environmental factors on the genetic issue. The other issue that you see there on this slide, that is worth slide 15, that is worth sort of talking about, is this phenomenon of crossover. So if it was as you know, if we were talking about simple inheritance, then you know, crossover would be less likely. And of course, there is a whole interesting phenomenology of people who begin with a syndrome of anorexia nervosa, often just restrictive, and then eventually in their lifetime, you know, meet criteria for bulimia nervosa. And that happens sometimes to as many as, you know, quite close to 2/3 And of course, the other way happens as well, maybe not as frequently, at least in the studies that have been done to date, but as many as a quarter of patients who start with bulimia type of symptoms will end up with an anorexia nervosa type syndrome. And of course, that goes against that whole idea of straight genetic influence, and implies that that interaction with the environment. So then, how do we inherit eating disorders? I think we need to think of this, as you see in slide 16, as complex heritability, an interaction likely between heritable vulnerability factors and heritable protective factors. Of course, we see the influence of constitutionality, meaning our own constitutional personal makeup, where personality and especially the temperament as the component of personality that can really bring a role to bear as far as predisposing factors are concerned, with a clear influence from the environment, which can also be either a protective environment or a promoting environment. And it seems like Westernization has been very influential in this concept of being a promoting environment from a social cultural perspective. So this next slide, slide 17, it's a slide that I really like because I think it helps me both understand and explain, this idea of, why are we seeing more eating disorders, or why are we seeing different presentations of eating disorders? Why are we seeing, people from all walks of life being affected, people from nearly all ages being affected? And I think that you could put, many different phenotypical expressions or, either disease processes or conditions, illnesses into this schema. So just to walk you through it, first let's look at sort of the left, to the left of the slide where it says incidence of eating disorders. And of course, in this scattergram, the dots represent, each dot represents sort of the expression of an eating disorder. Thinking about it as four quadrants, right? If we were to divide the white area of the slide in half, drawing a vertical line, then we would have, two halves there. One representing a resistant genetic predisposition, people whose genetics had more protective factors than vulnerability factors, and then the half on the right would sort of represent the more genetically prone, people who had more vulnerability factors involved. And then if we drew a horizontal line across the white square, then we would have two halves in which in the bottom half we would have the influence of a protective environment. So whether people were genetically resistant or genetically prone to an eating disorder, they lived in a protective environment. And of course the upper half would be a promoting environment, a westernized environment. And there we would have the sort of the four quadrants. So what this says is that if we have a genetically protected, right, resistant population that lives in a protective environment, then, we have limited expression of that particular phenotype, in this case of an eating disorder. And if we have moving to the right on the bottom, if we have a genetically vulnerable population that lives in a protective environment, we will still have quite a limited expression of the eating disorder. Now, moving to the top left quadrant, if we have a resistant population that lives in a promoting environment, we're going to see some movement upward, somewhat of a greater expression of an eating disorder. And of course, the right upper quadrant is probably where we are at today. And because this is a population that was genetically prone, by exposing them to a promoting environment, we have a greater expression of the phenotype, in this case, a greater expression of the eating disorder. So take a minute later to look at that slide. I think it really tells us, it paints a picture of what we're experiencing today. All right, so let's move on to understanding predisposing factors, and would you like to make some comments as to that? We're probably talking about two issues here as far as predisposing factors. One is temperamental traits, and the other one is psychiatric vulnerability, meaning comorbid or coexisting psychiatric conditions like anxiety, obsessiveness, depression, that can really contribute, can be a bit of a setup contributing to the possibility of the development of an eating disorder. Now let's sort of chat about temperamental traits for a second. So this definition is, so when we talk about temperament and character, we're really talking about the work of Robert Cloninger, who sort of described, has put forth a theory of personality as being made up of temperament, mostly sort of fixed traits that make up, contribute to our personality, and these sort of come with us. This is part of that constitutionality. They're a bit hardwired and tend not to change significantly through our lifetime. And the other one, the other component of personality would then be character. And then character would be a more malleable component, a more changeable component of personality. And, of course, can change, with circumstances, with maturity, and the like. So, in explaining this to young people, the example that I sort of like to use is that, under certain circumstances, even a very honest person may be, willing to take something that's not there. So, all of a sudden, you find yourself, in a war zone providing for your family, and you may take some bread, and bring it home because your family is in dire needs. So, the way that characterologically we deal with that, is changeable under different circumstances. However, the temperamental trait of that is that if we're talking about a harm avoidance individual who has low novelty seeking, they would be quite anxious as they do that. As opposed to somebody who was more novelty seeking and had less harm avoidance, who may become, more comfortable, doing that, in spite of being under, significant circumstances. So, in this example that I try to use to teach people how to differentiate, for example, is not, the behavior may be changeable under circumstances, but the temperamental traits determine how a particular individual may experience that behavior. So, in this slide 20, I think that we see that under predisposing factors, we have temperamental traits, and this really comes from the TCI, or Temperament Character Inventory, that Dr. Cloninger has developed. And we see that concerning eating disorders, harm avoidance is high, both in anorexia and in bulimia. However, novelty seeking, for example, that intuitive drive to sort of seek new experiences, to seek exciting experiences, tends to be quite low in anorexia and quite high in bulimia. Reward dependence, right? Higher in anorexia than in bulimia. And of course, persistence, is quite high, especially in the purely restrictive forms of anorexia nervosa. So you can see that this hardwiring, for example, can sort of help us sort of understand, the behaviors and where people drift behaviorally. Maybe some of that, crossover phenomena, that we discussed earlier has to do with, where temperamental traits eventually settle an individual in the context of their eating disorder behaviors. And I say settle in quotes. But you can see that a harm avoidant individual who's high novelty seeking, may be by far more likely to binge and then purge impulsively than a person who has the same harm avoidance but is quite low in novelty seeking and is unlikely to sort of cross that line, if you will. And of course, there are other characterological cognitive schemes that are, you know, sort of that we can, you know, see in the in this TCI or temperament and character inventory, like self-directedness, which tends to be typically low in eating disorder, in patients with eating disorders, you know, cooperation, which tends to be a bit higher in the anorexia nervosa population than in the bulimia nervosa population, and transcendence, which implies sort of thinking outside of yourself, thinking of the broader context and the like, and that becomes, you know, also an important part of the characterological schema. So moving on to slide 21, you know, we see that, you know, from the, and this is referring to comorbidity, to coexisting psychiatric conditions, this data just reminds us that the median age of onset of disorders like anxiety, impulse disorder, you know, is quite young, 11 years of age, substance abuse, 20 years of age, mood disorders, you know, 30 years of age, and of course, you know, half of all lifetime cases of mood disorder occurs by age 14, and three quarters by age 24. So there is significant psychiatric comorbidity in our population, in our young population, you know, in general, and of course, you know, coupled with the temperamental characteristics, you know, we can certainly think of, you know, psychiatric comorbidity as an important contributor to predisposing to the development of an eating disorder. Now, moving on, we can, you know, we can talk about precipitating factors. And this is interesting because obviously I think that the parallel here is to say, boy, you know, what happened? What triggered this? What, you know, and some patients report triggers, actually in some studies, in some series, almost half of patients that develop an eating disorder can identify a trigger, but half seem to not be able to say, yeah, this happened because or this started when. Now, moving on to slide 23, I got to tell you, this is an interesting survey. The American Psychological Association does these surveys every few years and puts them out. They're called Stress in America. Of course, the last one was a couple of years ago. What impact does a parent's stress have on a child? You know, really quite significant. And as you can see, nearly half of tweens really reported feeling sad, and just under half of teens feeling worried. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that at the time that this data was collected, you know, the economy had taken a downturn, and families were really struggling financially. So, you know, the idea is not just, you know, that teens and tweens may be, you know, really experiencing their own stress, which they clearly are, but also experiencing stress by proxy from the stress that, you know, adults and perhaps the society at large experiences. On the next slide, we see, you know, this cover of Newsweek magazine, the new first grade, and how complex life has become even for little kids. So I think we got to be careful balancing stimulation with creating an amount of stress that, especially for the more vulnerable, so for that, you know, perfectionistic, harm avoidant, you know, low novelty seeking individual, you know, especially if some, you know, in that context, you throw in the mix, you know, a bit of social anxiety, you know, or a low threshold to experience anxiety in general. And we have a recipe for a kid who begins to feel overwhelmed from a very early age with the best of intentions. So those are the broader context. So when we talk about specific precipitating factors, we need to think of puberty as an important precipitating factor. You know, it's not a benign event from a neurological, endocrinological situation. And we know that the brain and sex hormones, you know, brain function and sex hormones, brain development and sex hormones are closely tied together. So important to think about of puberty as an important life event with important consequences in a variety of areas, but certainly in you know, sort of experiencing some kids experiencing you know, a profound loss of control when you know, puberty comes into their life scene. I think we also need to really shift from viewing dieting and exercise just as gateway behaviors to the development of an eating disorder, and in addition to that, viewing them as important neurobiological triggers. These are not, you know, benign behaviors when it comes to the function of the brain, and the alterations that they may bring to our neurobiology, especially for individuals, you know, more vulnerable to the development of, you know, anxiety, obsessiveness, and extreme expressions of their perfectionism. And we know that certain high-risk activities, like the participation in some sports, especially the judged sports, where points for physique are awarded, is where the literature seems to be pointing. So there's a stratification of risk, if you will. So judged sports, riskier than refereed sports. And, you know, but certainly I think we need to take into account, as put forth in slide 26, that, you know, the participation in those sports may lead to, you know, a sense of, you know, teasing, bullying. You know, the reality is that it's not just about the sport or whether they're judged or refereed, but how each child sort of internalizes the experience given their temperament, their constitutionality, who they are. So teasing, bullying, a sense of social shunning, taking into account that, you know, it's really important to view these kids as quite sensitive individuals, especially the ones that are likely more likely to go on to develop an eating disorder. Social contagion, sort of, you know, what everybody's doing and what's happening around them. You know, if we live in a context in which thinness is valued, then, you know, kids are going to value thinness, and the more sensitive kids, the more vulnerable kids may actually be more affected by this. And, of course, the jury's still out as to what all these efforts on the war on obesity are going to imply for individuals with the potential to develop an eating disorder. So in summary, I think we can agree that eating disorders are serious illnesses. Younger children are being affected. Early recognition and timely intervention are critical. Parents or caretakers have an important role, both in recognizing their children at risk, you know, and trying to work with, you know, sort of protecting them from the exposures that may be precipitating to the extent that that's possible, lowering stress, lowering expectations, and perhaps being a little bit more choosy, more selective as to what these kids get involved in, seeking assessment and treatment on a timely basis. Don't delay. I mean, I think the message here is, you know, if you're concerned about the possibility of eating disorder-related pathology, don't delay in seeking assessment. And, of course, the other important opportunity for parents and caretakers, for families, is to be working with treatment teams as agents of change. And FPT is a great example of you know, where parents truly are at the center of that behavior change. I wanted you to have access to this paper published in Pediatrics showing a very significant increase in the number of hospitalizations for young children related to eating disorders between 1999 and 2006. So, you know, we need to pay attention to the younger ones because this is becoming a greater issue for them. And I also wanted to leave you with this, you know, brochure. We're on slide 29 now. It's called Critical Points for Early Recognition and Medical Risk Management in the Care of Individuals with Eating Disorders. It's been dubbed the Guide to Medical Care of Eating Disorders. It's put out by the Academy for Eating Disorders through a task force on medical care standards. And this is available, downloadable for free at www.aedweb.org, and it's aimed at the primary care providers, sort of setting a minimum standard of care for what early recognition, timely intervention, and medical risk management should be, you know, anywhere in the country and in the world around the care of eating disorders. And finally, I wanted to leave you with some papers that I think, or resources that I think may be important reference points as you sort of think about this and hence this slide 30th with core references. So with that, I think we will conclude and want to thank you for your attention.
And ladies and gentlemen, to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. At this time, we'd like to start the brief survey. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Survey question number one. This session provided me with a better understanding of what factors can cause an eating disorder. Please press star 1 if you strongly agree. Please press star 2 if you agree. Please press star 3 if you disagree. Please press star 4 if you strongly disagree. Please stand by while we allow everyone a chance to respond. Survey question number two. This session educated me on traits that lead a person to be at risk for developing an eating disorder. Please press star 1 if you strongly agree. Please press star 2 if you agree. Please press star 3 if you disagree. Please press star 4 if you strongly disagree. Once again, we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone a chance to signal. Survey question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Please press star 1 if you strongly agree. Please press star 2 if you agree. Please press star 3 if you disagree. And please press star 4 if you strongly disagree. Again, we'll pause briefly. Survey question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Please press star 1 if you agree. Or please press star 2 if you do not agree. Again, we'll pause briefly. And finally, survey question number 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Please press star 1 if you are an individual with an eating disorder. Please press star 2 if you are a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Please press star 3 if you are a health professional. Or please press star 4 if you are other. Thank you for participating in today's survey. Now we'd like to go to the question and answer session. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please be aware that a voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open to ask a question. And we do ask that you please state your name before posting your question. So once again, that is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question at this time. And once again, that is star 1 if you'd like to ask a question. We'll go ahead and take our first questioner.
Hi. I haven't been able to successfully pull up the slides, and I'm not sure if it's a website glitch or if it's on my end. I'm wondering if there's another way I can get access to the slides.
I believe that Kate can make those available to you. We'll be sure to discuss that after, when we debrief about this. And I'm sorry that you had trouble. I had a little trouble myself at one point, sort of moving their slides forward and had to, just open the laptop and not go through the main screen on the computer. And then it worked again. So I apologize for that. That could be very frustrating. But I do think that she'll be able to get the slides to you.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And I'd like to just make sure that we have a direct way to do that. If you would, after the call, just dial the number on the back of your Cigna card and ask for me by name. My name is Kate Partner.
Thank you.
Sure.
And once again, that is star one. If you'd like to ask a question, we'll go ahead and take our next questioner.
Hi, I wanted to ask, I have a daughter who is 13, and I recently found out that she has been having, she's been throwing up occasionally after her meals. She said she did in the beginning, it's been about a year, she did it for twice a month, in the beginning, and then it got out of control, and she did it kind of like weekly, maybe twice or three times a week. And she told me she hasn't done it for the past 2 months. And I'm in the process of taking her to see someone. But at what point do they diagnose her with bulimia? I mean, is she bulimic, or is this a start of it? I just want to understand more about it.
Yeah, that is such a good question. And I think a lot of people struggle with that. How do I think about this? And so here's what I would tell you. Let me answer, in a couple of different ways. Number one, she doesn't formally meet criteria for bulimia because it specifies, the number of times that you binge and purge, in a specific week and for a specified period of time. So formally, she would not meet criteria for bulimia. However, I think it's interesting and important to realize that this category currently of eating disorder not otherwise specified really accounts for, upwards of 50 to 60% of the patients that are diagnosed in clinical settings. If I'm running a clinic, that takes patients from that city, from that area, then, more than half of the patients that are going to come in with an eating disorder are not going to meet criteria for anorexia or for bulimia, but rather for eating disorder not otherwise specified under the current criteria. And that's probably where, a 13-year-old that has been sort of, purging after eating, not necessarily binging, for about a year, has done it on average about twice a month and hasn't done it for the past couple of months, would probably fit. Now, the other side of my answer is, let's just assume that she stopped and she never induces vomiting again. I would still be quite concerned about what got her there. In other words, how vulnerable is this kid to the development of an eating disorder that may look quite differently from, self-inducing vomiting. So, she has a, God willing, a long life ahead. And you want to make sure that it's a healthy life, both from a, physical medical perspective, but also from an emotional psychological perspective. So I would not drop my concern because she reassures you that, she hasn't engaged in that particular behavior for the last 2 months. Because I think to me the most important question is what got her there to begin with, and how can we, do the best that we can to understand where she's at and equip her with some tools to not move in the direction of eating disorder behavior, whether it's purging or otherwise, either now or in the future.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next questioner. Call, your line is open. Please check your mute function.
Oh, thank you. Hello. In one of the slides you had up, it was a 50 to 80% inheritability factor, and I was curious of how much of that is in, when you say inheritability, but then I guess what the question is that how much of that is preventable? What do you do to bring those percentages down? Is it environmental, or was that the genetic component?
Right. No, very, very good question. Thank you. And what I would tell you is that what we need to think about the heritability, the genetic component, really has to do with those, vulnerability factors. It's not that, you know, it's not that if I have anorexia or bulimia, you know, I have 50 or 80% chances that I'm going to pass it on to my children. It's just that, you know, from the perspective of my children, my children's level of risk, the component of risk that they have is 50 to 80%, you know, from their genetics, which is, of course, not one parent's, but, you know, from the two family lines. And it has to do with, for example, how harm avoidant, how novelty seeking, you know, how self-directed, you know, so on and so forth, an individual is likely to end up. So the risk is not about, you know, gee, I've passed on anorexia to you, or the you know, the genetic probability of having anorexia. I think that it probably should be viewed more as, look, in our family, certain temperamental personality characteristics run, and you get either a greater or a lesser dose of the characteristics that may predispose you to the development of an eating disorder. And no one characteristic is the issue. In other words, you know, I can be very, you know, harm avoidant, for example, but not develop an eating disorder. You know, I may be quite a shy person that, you know, is quite functional, and find a pattern in my life and, you know, set of relationships that support who I am, and I have a very successful life. Now, you know, my offspring can have the same harm avoidance, and combined with other, personality factors may actually end up developing an eating disorder. So it's not as clear cut as, you know, I pass on even the possibility. I think it's about sort of the roll of the dice, if you will, in the way that we pass on our own characteristics and the characteristics in our family lines, how they combine with the characteristics in the other family line, and so what tends to render an individual more or less vulnerable to the development of an eating disorder.
Thank you.
And there are no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back to Ms. Harner.
Okay. Thank you so much to everyone for attending, and thank you to Dr. Bermudez for providing us with such wonderful insights today. If you do have any specific questions about any of the therapies discussed today, please contact the eating disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. And please also be sure to mark your calendars to join our Eating Disorder Awareness Seminar next month. It'll be on Tuesday, August 28th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and that's 10 a.m. Pacific. Thanks, everyone.
That does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.